This is the Nobody's Anonymous talk, how to track, identify, and classify spam, or as I like to call it, how to find a covert channel. Before we begin, let me just say that we all hate spam, and I'm not here to tell you how to stop it. Spam is a problem, and problems cannot be resolved until they have been identified and classified. So in this presentation, I'm going to describe to you forensic and profiling techniques and how to apply them to spam. I'm going to show you methods to classify and track spam, as well as how to identify individual spammers, either down to it's Bill, or at least saying all of these messages are from the same person. And I'm going to do this using real-world examples. Now, I'm sure a lot of people are interested in just hearing about the covert channels, the hidden messages in spam. Unfortunately, you can't find the covert channels. Unfortunately, you can't find the covert channels unless you know how to identify, classify, and track your spam. And you can't do that kind of organization without having a basic understanding of how email works. So let's begin. Email itself is a plain file transfer protocol. Every file is an email, and every email has three components. There's the meta header, consisting of field colon value pairs, like to colon you, from colon me, the blank line that separates the header from the content, and then the content itself, which is usually plain text or HTML. So if we look at the life cycle of an email, you start off with number one down in the corner, composing your email, where you specify the content, the subject, and the recipient. Then you hit the send button. When you hit the send button, your local mail system populates the initial mail header in yellow. From there, it's passed to various mail relays, which apply more headers and route the data to the final recipient system where it gets delivered. Eventually, the recipient starts up their mail program, retrieves their email, and actually views it. So now that you know how Here's an example email. You can see that we specified the subject, the recipient, and the content, and then we hit the send button, which populated the initial mail header in yellow. From there, it was passed to the various mail relays. In this case, it went from the yellow to the orange to the blue to the green, where it was finally delivered. That green header at the top is called the last received header because it was added last. Now that you know how email works, we can actually start talking about how to forge email. You see, the simple mail transport protocol was never designed for security. Because of this, email is trivial to forge, and fake email can be easily passed to various mail delivery agents for actual delivery. The reason this is important is that most spammers forge email. They can forge things like the subject, the date, the message ID, the recipients, to, from, carbon copies, blind carbon copies. They don't have to stick with these standard headers, they can create their own. And the content, the body of the email, can say whatever they want. Finally, that stack of received headers, the initial ones, the ones at the bottom of the stack, can be easily forged. What cannot be easily forged are the final received headers, the ones at the top of the stack. And every final received header should have an origination IP address and timestamp, and those also are difficult to forge. So when you see a non-standard email header like this one, where although all the received headers are valid, the machine lied about its sending IP address, where the message ID is not in a standard or common format, where there's a unique header, XMSJQU, whatever that is, and even a well-defined field, the date field, is in the wrong format, well, you can be pretty certain that this email is forged and that it's probably spam, and you can tell that without ever reading the subject. The big clues to look for are the received headers. Every received header has a from and a by address in it, so you'll see received from machine 1 by machine 2, and on the next header it'll say from machine 2 by machine 3. If you don't see that chaining, 1 to 2, 2 to 3, then chances are you're looking at a fake received header. Also look for non-standard headers, or standard ones that are in wrong or just very different formats. Things like the date, the received header, the message ID. Look at the header labels themselves, the capitalization. Does it vary? So now that you know what to look for, we can actually start talking about how to organize our spam. Most people that do spam research organize spam by the content, and this gives you things like the spamdemic map, which shows which company hired which marketing agency, which outsourced to which spam group to send the email. Unfortunately, that doesn't tell you who actually pressed the send button. To find out who pressed the send button, we organize by the headers. You see, spammers use tools, and tools act consistently. They will have the same headers in the same order with the same inconsistencies each and every time. If there's hash busters, those unique strings that you'll see in the subject or the content that are used to bypass hash-based spam filters, then the hash busters will be in the same location and in the same format each and every time. The other important thing to remember is that spammers are people, and people will act consistently, at least until they need to change. In particular, spammers will not change their tools until their tools become ineffective. The other thing we've noticed is that most spammers are cheap. While there are commercial bulk mailing programs out there, they're fairly expensive. So most spammers will actually write their own tools or hire some kid to write it for them. And although these unique programs may get shared a little bit, they're going to be used in very different ways and they don't get very big distributions. So what you end up with is a unique individual using a unique tool in a unique way that generates a unique set of headers. What else do you need to track them? To give you an example of how this works, here's a couple of days worth of email that we received. Now, for the people in the back, this is probably hard to read, so the columns are the date that we received the email, and you can see that we receive a good amount of email each day that's spam. There's the sender, which is almost always fake. There's the number of lines in the message, which gives you an idea of the size of the message. And then there's the various subjects and subject hash busters. Trying to find an individual out of this mess is like finding a needle in a haystack. But there are things we can do to simplify the problem. For example, there's a large number of emails that have capital letter hash busters at the end of the subject line. So if we just take a look at all the spam messages that have capital letter hash busters at the end of the subject line, we get some amount of organization. And we can start going through these emails looking for other inconsistencies that stand out, that make them unique. For example, there's a significant number of emails that have a date with a time zone of negative 1600 or negative 1700 hours. Now, for those of you who don't know how time zones work, on planet Earth, there is no time zone negative 1600 hours. This makes it pretty unique. So if we just take a look at all the emails with a time zone negative 1600 hours and a capital letter hash buster on the subject line, we end up with a large amount of organization. I'm going to start from the right and just work my way to the left. The hash buster is almost always separated from the subject. The subject usually ends with punctuation, either an exclamation point or a question mark. There's a variety of subjects that seem to rotate, but the file sizes are roughly the same size. Every single one of the fake email addresses claims to come from Hotmail.com. They're not actually from Hotmail.com, that's just where they claim to come from. And the fake account names appear to be a regular name followed by a number, like Seawood83 or Bjorn59. The other thing to notice is the date. While we may receive one, two, even four messages on any given day from the spammer, he also sends email inconsistently. He may take off a day, a couple days, even a week at a time. In contrast, the person from negative 1700 hours has a very different fingerprint. His hash busters almost always connected to the subject. His subjects usually do not end with punctuation, but if it does, it's an exclamation point. His file sizes are, on average, smaller than the person from negative 1600 hours. And every one of his fake email addresses claims to come from yahoo.com. Every one of his fake account names appears to be repetitive letters followed by a number, like BCV, BCV32, or CXZ, XCA12. In fact, most of these characters come from the left-hand side of the keyboard. The particular bulk mailing tool that this guy uses requires you to specify your fake account name, and there's two ways you can do it. You can either import a list of account names to use, or you can type them in by hand. In this case, he's drumming his left hand on the keyboard, BCV, BCV, that's drumming, they're adjacent on the keyboard, or CXZ, XCA, that's rolling your fingers. And then with his right hand on the mouse, he's clicking the enter button. Since his right hand is on the mouse, chances are really good that he's right-handed. The other thing to notice is the date. This person sends spam consistently. We receive 2 to 4 messages a day, every day from him. But he does take the occasional time off, like Thanksgiving, the 4th of July, Super Bowl Sunday, a couple of days after Christmas. even though he always relays through OpenSSOC servers that could be located anywhere in the world. We know he's in the United States. We've even narrowed it down to the Los Angeles basin with periodic travel in March to Chicago. And in the fall to Mexico City, he's also a Raiders fan because he doesn't send spam when there's a home game. To summarize how to organize your spam, for the most, ignore the contents in the subject because the text changes way too easily and the contents may actually be borrowed from some other spammer. Instead, focus on the headers and those signatures. Identify those common inconsistencies, those are your fingerprints, and then organize by your fingerprints. So now that you know what to look for and how to look for it, we can start defining spam and identifying the major spam categories. The problem with defining spam is that everyone has a definition, and every definition is different. So in keeping with this tradition, here is my definition of spam. We define spam as undesirable email. An undesirable email can be classified by its intended purpose. The most common classes are unsolicited commercial email, non-responsive commercial email, list makers, scams, and covert messages that are camouflaged as spam. So to give an idea of how they work, let's talk about the true commercial categories. These make up the minority of spam. Things like unsolicited commercial email. This is the easiest type of spam to identify because it's an actual customer trying to contact existing or potential customers. So how do you identify them? Well, there's no forged mail headers because a real company has nothing to hide. There's only one recipient, and that's you, because a real company doesn't want their customers to know who their other customers are. The from address will match the reply to address, other identifiers in the header, as well as the contact methods. And there'll be multiple contact methods, by email, by web, by street address, by phone. This is because a real company wants their customers to contact them. The email content itself is frequently personalized, polite, very direct. It'll get your attention, and it won't ask to be forwarded. Having said that, true unsolicited commercial email is extremely rare. We're currently seeing one out of every 2,000 to 5,000 spam messages that we receive. That is less than 1%. If all unsolicited commercial email were to vanish today, no one would notice. To give an example of unsolicited commercial email, here's one we got from a company called CoSaint. They do computer security training. The IP address matches the host name, which is repeated throughout in the header, as well as in the contact methods, and all the contact methods are verifiable. The email is actually personalized, but there's a problem. The problem is the email address they sent it to is only found in one place. It's a GIF image on a web page. This means that someone had to come across that web page, entered it into their mailing list by hand, or by some automated tool that can do character recognition on an arbitrary GIF, and then added us to their mailing list believing that we cared. Our name appears on the same web page as the GIF image. After receiving email from them for a couple of months, we sent them a very polite email asking to be removed, and they had no problem with that. They removed us, no questions asked. The problem is not that we had to ask to be removed. The problem is that they added us in the first place. The second category is non-responsive commercial email. This is an actual company trying to contact previous customers. So as far as identification goes, it looks just like UCE. No false headers, only one recipient, lots of contact methods, and so on. The key difference is that the user initiated contact and then opted out from future communications. Even though the user opted out, the NC will violate the do not contact request and continue to send you email. To give you an example of an NCE, here's Comcast. How many people here have Comcast broadband internet? A lot of hands, yeah. Last December, you did receive an email that looks like this. It's from Comcast telling you about Comcast shopping, where you can get things like Gucci sunglasses. Yeah. At the very end of the email was a little paragraph that said, "Not sure why you've received this email? Check your Comcast email contact preferences at the following URL." And they even listed their privacy statement and terms of service. So we went and checked our contact preferences. We had opted out more than 6 months prior, but Comcast still sends us email. Now, the really funny thing is that although they allow you to opt out of special offers, promotions, and features, they can still send you things that are service related. And after I made this public at Black Hat in Seattle last January, Comcast changed their email. Now it says things like, customers like you have asked to change their email. You'll like our new look. You'll love our new features. Didn't I say I didn't want to hear about features? Things like improved navigation, easier use of attachments, and sharper graphics. But that's okay, because this email is service related. They also removed the link to how to, which goes to where to opt out, and they removed their terms of service. Now, Comcast is not the only NCE out there. There's lots of others, like Amazon.com, where you actually have to opt out twice. Or Angelfire, also known as Lycos or Tripod Productions. As long as you have an account with them, they'll send you email. Barnes & Noble Bookseller has a subsidiary called Barnes & Noble University. Barnes & Noble Bookseller is not an NCE. Barnes & Noble University is. And even computer companies like VeriSign and Hewlett-Packard are NCEs. The big catch with all NCEs is that if you don't subscribe, if you don't sign up with them, if you don't purchase their product online, if you don't give them your email address, you won't receive their spam. But regardless of how much spam you get from UC and NCE, it is likely to be nothing compared to the amount that you're getting from the non-commercial categories. These make up the vast majority of spam and is usually much greater than 99%. Things like list makers. List makers make money by harvesting email addresses and then selling those email addresses to other list makers, to marketing agencies, or to spammers. They may even claim to manage mailing lists for other companies. Most list makers keep track of three types of email addresses. What we call grade A, or known good, it means somebody replied. And a reply can be anything. It could be, I'm interested, please tell me more, or please remove me from your mailing list, or I'm out of the office until Tuesday. It doesn't matter. Any reply is a good reply. Then there's grade B, which is probably good. There was no reply at all. And grade C, which is known bad. The email actually bounced. So how do list makers work? Well, first they harvest email addresses from websites, from news forums, from mailing groups, from wherever they can. Unfortunately, they don't know if what they harvested is an actual email address. So what they do is they send out a test message. And they don't just send out one, they send out a whole bunch of them on a variety of topics. The idea is basically like phishing. If the one piece of bait doesn't work, try another. Then they watch for the reply. Did it bounce? Grade C. Did nothing happen? Grade B. Did they get any kind of reply at all? Grade A. To give an example of a list maker, here's Mark 9, operated by Stephen Fuller out of Spokane, Washington, who, today, will happily sell you a 500,000 email addresses for $20. Now, the nice thing about Mark 9 is back in 1997, they had a misconfigured web server. No, I did not hack it. If you connected to their web server, you didn't see a pretty web page. Instead, what you saw was their spam directory. Every one of these numbered directories is a completely different offer. Things like big name brand products below wholesale. The other interesting directory is their names directory. This is their actual mailing list. Every one of these files are in the exact same format. A whole bunch of email addresses, one per line. Now, the reason we know that they're a list maker is because of that file called Opportunity Seekers. You see, they sent out a whole bunch of opportunities, and they collected a whole bunch of email addresses, but there's nothing linking the email address to the opportunity. Therefore, they're only interested in the email addresses, and that makes them a list maker. And how many email addresses did they have? Well, back in 1997, when spam technology was nowhere near as sophisticated as it is today, they had 15.5 million email addresses. Of those, 5,000 are grade A, about 200,000 are grade C, and all the rest are grade B. Now, unfortunately, the motive behind list makers are not always obvious. For example, take this news report, where criminals appear to be taking mailing lists, sending out emails, and looking for the out-of-office messages. You see, your out-of-office message gives your name, Some information that could be used to find out where you live, either a phone number or a place of work or a city, state, something like that. And the exact dates when you're not going to be home so they can burglarize you. So how do you identify a list maker? Well, there's usually forged headers. There'll be a valid from address and a valid reply to address, although they may not match the content or each other. Today, you'll usually see an HTML attachment, which includes a web bug for validation. For those of you who don't know, a web bug is basically a link to a remote web server to retrieve an image, and it has a unique ID associated with it. So when you get the email and you open it up under Outlook, Outlook sees the image link, goes out to the server, and brings back the image. And that server receives a unique ID, so now they know who read what email, when, how many times, and for what kind of system. You also won't see just one URL. You'll see lots of them, going out to lots of different sites. This is because list makers expect to be shut down. And so by having more places to receive the information, they have a better chance of validating their mailing list. And if you actually manage to catch a list maker, what you end up seeing is a huge email address list in the 10 million or larger range. The largest we've seen so far is 25 million, and we've heard that there are some as large as 250 million. Now, list maker technology is not necessarily its own group. For example, UCEs may use list maker technology, web bugs, that sort of thing, in order to track their mailing list. Or people running scams may also act as a list maker in order to earn money both from the scam and from selling their mailing list. And that takes us to the next category, scams. The purpose of scam is to acquire valuable assets from people. And valuable assets could be anything. It could be money, personal information, or computer resources. This is where things like worms and viruses come in. The whole idea behind a scam is misrepresentation. So how do you identify a scam? Well, there's usually forged headers, and the subject may not match the message content. I mean, when was the last time you received an email that said, "I'm a virus, double click on me"? It won't be from a legitimate company. The from address and may not match the reply to address or the contact information or even be valid. There's usually multiple recipients listed on the to line, the carbon copy line, and you may actually be a blind carbon copy. There's usually justification for the contact and any weird methods that they may have, such as you requested this, or some sad story about not being able to get their money out of Nigeria. And of course, it'll read like a scam. Pyramid schemes, Ponzi schemes, easy promises, quick wins, lose fat now. They're usually money related, with contact either by phone or post office, or by web or email, but usually not both. To give an example of a scam, here's ProHosiery out of Taiwan. We immediately identified this as being a scam because on the from line, the domain name doesn't exist. But that's okay, because in between the misspelling and the poor grammar, they justify why it doesn't exist. They say, and I quote, "Because for some reasons at the beginning, it is not proper for us to reveal our email address and website. So if you respond to us, please be sure to fax." What kind of company doesn't want their customers to know who they are? This is a scam. Which takes me on to the first big case study we have. It's a group that we call Gone Phishing. I'm sure you've all seen emails like this. "Dear Citibank member, we need you to verify your email address by clicking on this link and entering in all your personal information." For someone who hasn't seen this, at first glance, it could probably even look like a real email from Citibank. But there's a couple of problems. Like a typo, because, which probably would have never made it out of Citibank's quality assurance. Or the hash buster, the dash T dash, the K, the Y and C down at the bottom. Every person that received this email received different letters. And then there's the URL, which starts off citibank.com, but the host name is actually after the at sign. In this case, it's a host in Russia. But if you didn't notice all of that and you clicked on the link, what you saw was the Citibank webpage in the background and a little pop-up in the foreground. The Citibank webpage in the background really is Citibank. But the little pop-up in the foreground comes from the Russian web server. And it asks you for your credit card number, your PIN number, and regardless of what you enter, it says, "Your email address was successfully verified. Thank you." Now, this was, of course, the first revision of their scam. The second revision asked for your credit card number, your PIN number, and your expiration date. And the one after that asked for your email address. Now, the nice thing about this particular phishing group is that they screwed up. You see, the very first email that they sent out used a Russian web bug for tracking the people that clicked on the links. And anyone who knows the Russian web bug ID could go to the Russian web server and find out all the information related to the web bug. So in this case, we saw that the scam went out on August 16, 2003, and 100,000 people clicked on the link. The next day, 90,000 people clicked on the link. And then it quickly dropped down to zero. Now, the interesting part is not that there were 100,000 people that clicked on the link on the first day. The interesting thing is that one person clicked on it the day before. In fact, in the week before, there were, what, 10, 11 hits against this web bug that's only been used for this scam. So who would be hitting the web bug before the scam goes out? It's the software tester, absolutely, the developer. And we can pull up the fine details and see that 8 of those 10 hits. We can see that 8 of those 10 hits came from a residential DSL line located in Tybouts Corner, Delaware. Repeated scans with in-map against the system showed the presence of a firewall with no open ports. In other words, this system was very unlikely to have been compromised. Does anyone want to take a guess at where the developer was probably located? Tybouts Corner, Delaware. Now, that's just one type of analysis we can do. The other type is with the phishing header. You see, the message ID here is fairly unique. It consists of 16 characters, letters and numbers, followed by an at sign and the company they're pretending to be. So we can go to places like the Great Spam Archive that has been collecting spam since 1997 and say, how many times has this format of message ID been seen? And what we see is that between 1997 and 2003, it was only seen in a very tight date cluster. What this indicates is a unique bulk mailing tool being used by a limited distribution or a small group. Then we can take a look at how it's been used. For example, a large number of them were used for scams. Some were used for phishing, and of those, some of them used malware. Then we can go through all the different spam archives out there and collect all the emails related to phishing and this particular format of message ID. They used keyboard capture programs like Trojan Download Burbu or Exploit Codebase. And these programs have a little bit of consistency. They were all written in C, they were all compiled with the same type of compiler, and they all used an old exploit technique. This group is not doing anything zero-day or novel. Then we can go through all the different spam archives and collect all the emails related to this particular message ID and phishing. And what we see is that the group started off using malware, but quickly progressed to website impersonation, primarily targeting eBay and Citibank. The other interesting thing is that on October 20th, they did a 419 scam, a Nigerian scam. And this is really important because Nigerian scams are not run by individuals. This means they had a group of people. Unfortunately, the 419 scam that they sent out was a really bad copy, and they probably had no takers. So it looks like they took their additional manpower and applied it to their time-tested and proven-to-work method of website impersonation, targeting 5 banks in 3 days. Of those 5 banks, the 4 new ones are all located in the UK, England. Does anyone want to take a guess where the additional manpower probably came from? So to summarize this group, they're a serial phishing group. They use a unique bulk mailing tool. They primarily target Citibank and eBay. As far as membership goes, they have at least one person located in Tybouts Corner, Delaware, although they do have some members in Europe and most likely in the UK. The group has played with email trojans and 419 scams, but they appear to be most comfortable with website impersonations. And this group is still active today. And that leaves us with the final group, or the final category, covert messages. So the purpose of a covert message is to have a secret communication. So you'd think, if I'm going to have a secret communication, why would I do it over spam? Well, there's actually a whole bunch of really good reasons. First and foremost, it is hiding in plain sight. Every person in this room has been trained to receive spam and delete it without ever opening it. And if you don't open it, if you don't read it, you won't see the hidden message. Email is trivial to forge and difficult to trace. And if you can't trace it, chances are it goes to an open proxy or a compromised host. In other words, the sender is anonymous. Spam is a broadcast mechanism. In other words, if you know that this email is a covert message, you also know that it went to 1 million other people and you don't know who they are. In other words, the recipient is anonymous. Unlike instant messenger or chat rooms, you don't need to be online in order to receive the message. It'll wait for you in your mailbox. And to take a phrase out of the X-Files, it provides plausible deniability. So you know who the bad guy is, you've got your warrant, you confiscate his computer, and you look at the hard drive, and all you see is spam. What are the chances that you'll recognize the spam as being a covert message, that you can show he knew it was a covert message, and that he was the intended recipient? That's plausible deniability. So how do you identify a covert channel? It is not any of the other categories. If you try to classify spam from covert channel into any of the other categories, it won't fit. The other categories will send email to every person on their mailing list. But a covert channel has multiple people with multiple mailing lists. So if you monitor two different email accounts, you'll see the email sometimes goes to one account, sometimes to another, and sometimes to both, indicating one, two, three different mailing lists. The other spam groups do everything they can to get past spam filters. Covert channels like spam filters. They'll design their spam to be caught by it. This cuts down on the number of casual recipients. If you take a look at the email, you'll see something that's not random in the headers, the content, or the signature. And since the whole purpose of the spam is to use it as camouflage, why should they create their own when they can just borrow somebody else's spam? So what you'll see is that this message is normally found with this spam group, and this message is normally found with this spam group, but this weird spam group is using messages from both groups. Although they reuse content, they usually do not reuse porn or a really good scam, and this is because they know that people look at porn, and people read scams and fall for them. And since they don't want the casual recipient to look too closely, they don't use it. If they reuse email that contains HTML, it frequently has invalid or broken links the second you receive the email. And if they happen to reuse email from a list maker, then everybody gets the exact same unique ID. And this takes me into the second really big case study, a group that we call the Hangouters. They're an elite group, that is, they use elite text encoding, misspellings, phonetic spellings, similar shape character replacements, and so on, in order to encode their messages. So here is the first email we received from this group. The thing that really made it stand out was the message ID. You see, the message ID is not in a standard format. In fact, it looks more like a Windows GUID, Globally Unique Identifier, than a email message ID. And while we were staring at that, wondering why would they use a GUID in place of a message ID, our eyes drifted over to the host name, and that looks like leaked text. Can anybody read it? Anybody? FP1 nasty. Three looks like an S with a half twist. I'll jump ahead a little bit and tell you that FP stands for Filipino. Filipino 1 nasty or Filipino I nasty. The other thing we noticed was the reply to address. You see, that doesn't look like a random email address. That actually looks like it has three components. The first part, 75573.270, looks like an old-style CompuServe email address. CQ could be a reference to amateur radio, such as calling or seeking someone. Or maybe a reference to ICQ, which is chat room software. And then DIR7, dirt. This is somebody looking for dirt. The content itself was reused from some other spammer, but they had added onto it a little piece of JavaScript designed to prevent someone from viewing the HTML source code. And then at the very end, they have a hash buster. So, okay, lots of spam ends with signature hash busters. This isn't unique. Except that we've already seen leaked text, and this looks leaked. In fact, it says, Governor of Class B, OG, I guess, UJF. UJF is the University of Joseph Ferrier in Grenoble, France, and just about every one of their network services are found on Class B subnets. About a week and a half later, we received this email. We identified as being from the same group because of the message ID, and I'm just going to read to you what the lead text says. So starting at the reply to line, it says, Chris025 for Karen. On the message ID, easy, Casey, for fag. On the subject line, Casey, you fuck hardware boy. And in the final signature, whose photos, Cy? I love your tools. When I see this, I see a lot of names. There's Cy, there's Casey, there's Karen, and there's Chris025, who's actually the easiest person to find. You see, at the time, Google said that there were only about 30 web pages that contained the spring Chris025. And of those 30 web pages, only one of them was interesting. It's a Filipino IRC group called the Hangouters. There's Chris025, he goes by the handle Data, there's a picture of him. And whose photos, Cy? Cy could be short for Cyber Sad, another one of the group members' names. Now, we weren't able to find the governor of Class B, but if you take a look at the other email addresses, you can see that there is a Tsarina, a Duchess, and on another webpage there was a Miss Mayor. So governor does not seem out of place. Now, of course, we're not exactly certain that Cy is the same as Cyber Sad, but we received this email. It says, Sabrina to Cy, T-S-I, pronounced Cy. So is there a link between someone named Sabrina and someone named Cyber Sad? Of course. It's another Filipino IRC group called the IRC Addicts. Here's a list of their members. There's Sabrina and there's Cyber Sad. And in fact, there's lots of members of the Hangouters that are also members of the IRC Addicts. By the way, who is Sabrina anyway? We don't know her actual name, but she took the handle Sabrina from the TV show Sabrina the Teenage Witch, the cartoon series, not the sitcom. Now, up until this point, I've only shown you one-directional emails, but there actually have been bi-directional conversations. Like this one, asking yes, no about something. On the subject line, it says, do you go exchanging? Probably a reference to relaying through Microsoft Exchange servers. And in the final signature hash buster, is KCT5, whatever T5 is, and me too, do you cross either the Ukraine or Australia to exchange? 35 minutes later, a different email account that we monitor received this email. If you notice, they have the same headers and the same content. Even the message ID is almost identical, which wouldn't happen with a Windows GUID. The first one was asking yes, no about something. It said, do you go exchanging? This one responds, I do. Their favorite is in fast gigabit. And by the way, they cross through Brazil. The other thing we can do is a little bit of data analysis. Since they have a unique message ID header, we can go through all the different spam archives and collect all the emails related to this particular message ID header. And then we can do things like a volume analysis. You see, the big bulk mailing groups out there, we use a spam tool that runs 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So if you do an hourly analysis, what you see is a fairly linear distribution. Then the mid-sized spammers usually start the program around the same time of day. So what you'll see is a bell curve. In this case, we don't see a bell curve and we don't see a linear distribution. What we see are two peaks at 0300 hours and 0700 hours. To get something like this, what we would expect is a group that is running the program by hand. It doesn't take very long to run, but if they're running by hand, that means they're probably awake, and if they're probably awake, then it's probably daylight hours. So if we rotate this so that the majority of the emails happen during daylight hours, what we get is GMT plus 6 to GMT plus 10. That's the Asia-Pacific region, with the Philippines happening at GMT plus 8, right in the middle. So if this is the Philippines, then we're looking at someone who primarily sends spam at 7 a.m. and 3 o'clock in the afternoon. That sounds like someone in school. The other thing we can do is a day of the week analysis. And what we see is that the majority of spam comes out 4 days a week. So the question is there a school in the Philippines that has a 4-day school week? So for those of you who don't know about Asian culture, a 6-day school week is really common. A 5-day school week is not common, it's fairly rare, but it's not unheard of. But a 4-day school week, does this even exist in Asia? Sure it does. Here's one example. The Cebu International School, located in Cebu City, the Philippines, offers a 4-day school week, although they don't say which 4 days. Depending on your grade level, you will have lunch sometime during the 11 o'clock hour, and regardless of your grade level, you'll be out of school by 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Now, it's important to note that this is not necessarily the only match. There is no indication that this school is linked to the spammers or that this school has been used for spamming. Do not attack the school. What this match suggests is that the hypothesis that the spammers are likely school age and attend a 4-day school week in the Philippines is not improbable. So to summarize the Hangouters, they're a Filipino IRC group with members located worldwide in the Philippines, Canada, the United States, and France. Although they primarily communicate over IRC, they will augment their communications with covert messages embedded in spam. Now, it's important to also remember that not all members of the Hangouters are involved in this, only a few. And some people that are not part of the Hangouters have used this tool. In fact, they passed it to a Brazilian hacking group that used it to stage an attack against Hotmail accounts. The other important thing to remember is that this group has been inactive for over a year. Don't bother hunting them down. They've already stopped. What you should take away from this is not that there are some Filipino kids out there sending hidden messages in spam. What you should take away is that covert messages in spam are real and active and in use today. The other thing to remember is that if the kids can do it, so can the adults. So when I read news reports like this, which link hidden messages embedded in 419 scams to terrorist activities such as assassinations and coup attempts in West Africa, well, I haven't seen the emails, I haven't seen this group, I haven't seen these hidden messages, but there's nothing to make me doubt that this can be done because I've already seen kids doing it. Now, there's two types of covert channels. There's potential and there's true. A potential covert channel means the group stands out as being abnormal. We just don't know anything else about them. We just know that they're not any of the other spam categories. A true covert channel means that we know anything else about them, who they are, what they're saying, where they are, their purpose for the channel, their encoding method, anything else. The Hangouters are a true covert channel. We know just about everything about them. But this group, the Abuse Tracking Group, and you'll understand the name in a moment, it's a potential covert channel. They seem weird, but we don't know anything else about them. So I'm going to go over what their emails look like, as well as a little bit of header and content analysis. So here is an entire email from the Abuse Tracking Group. If you've ever looked at spam, spam really can be this messy. That doesn't stand out. The things that stand out is that there's no message ID, which is supposed to be a required field. The date is not in English. We've actually seen many different languages. And there's this unique header called Abuse Tracking, followed by what appears to be random characters. Except that those characters aren't random. You see, that's my email address, base64 encoded twice. If you encode it one time, you get that string that starts with a D and ends with an A. And if you encode it a second time, you get that second string that starts with a Z and ends with a B and is what we just saw. In fact, every person that receives spam from this group has a different abuse tracking header because they have a different email address. And then there's the contents, which are really messy. You can see HTML in white, a whole bunch of hash busters in yellow, and my base64 single encoded message ID, email address, twice, once at the top and once at the bottom. To make this a little more legible, what I'm going to do is I'm simply going to remove the hash buster and show you the HTML code. So here's what the HTML code looks like when I remove all the hash busters. And what we see are a whole bunch of host names and unique identifiers. First thought, this sounds like a list maker, except that there's a problem. That first domain name, according to Spam House, is registered to a known spammer, a guy named Daniel Ivins. But he uses a variety of topics, he doesn't use long hash busters, and he changes IDs regularly. In other words, he's a list maker. Those other two domain names are also list makers, but they're not Daniel Ivins. It appears as though someone has taken parts from three different spam messages that are out there, pasted them together in order to create a spam message. These emails that we've seen from the abuse tracking group also do not contain very much content variety. They contain those long hash busters, and every person that receives the emails receives the exact same message ID. Unique ID. In fact, if you get onto Google and you search for 396552, you'll see lots of people that have received lots of email from this group. I mentioned that the content really doesn't change. Here's the email that I just showed you, and I'm going to overlay it with an email that we received from them almost a month later. And what we see is that the HTML doesn't change, the unique identifiers don't change. The only thing that changes are the hash busters. So just as I showed you removed the hash buster to look at the content, this time I'm going to remove the content to look at the hash busters. When I do that, here's the hash busters in the order that they appear. And the first thing that stands out is the repetition. 3921 appears twice. 84x5 appears three times. So that's sort of interesting. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to reflow this. I'm going to remove every space and every carriage return. And wherever I see a duplication, I'm going to put in my own carriage return. And when I do that, I get sequences that are 128 characters long. For those of you who are not in cryptography, 128 is like a magic number. The first sequence, 3921, is 128 characters long and then partially repeated. Then there's the second string, 84x5, fully repeated and then partially repeated. In fact, some emails from this group have only one sequence that's repeated multiple times. Other emails contain two sequences, with each one repeated at least in part, and no interlacing between the two sequences. So the big question is, are these strings random? I mean, they contain more numbers than letters, so that's sort of a little inconsistency. But the big thing that we can do is called a Phi Test Delta IC. It's basically an index of coincidence, and it measures the number of repeats. So if these strings were actually random, we would expect a delta IC around 1.0. And if they're English text, which is not random unless you spell like my brother, then you would expect a delta IC value between 1.5 and 2.0. So now that you know what a delta IC should look like, we can test these strings. And what we see is that they are consistently between 1.35 and 2.0. That is, they are consistently above random. They test negative for monoalphabetic and polyalphabetic substitution ciphers. So we don't actually know what the encoding method is. The other interesting thing about this group is that we can start looking for duplicates. I mean, if someone's going to use the same encoding scheme, then you would expect them to use the same messages every now and then. So in this case, let's just take message number 10. We email every email. It contains this 5444 string. Since it's partially repeated, we don't actually know where the start of the sequence is. So there's no problem if we rotate the sequence to start with the 5444. We can then compare it to email number 7, which was received 3 days earlier. And what we see is a huge amount of identical characters. In fact, out of 128 characters, there are only 21 differences. And of those 21 differences, 19 of them are incremental. Y to Z, 6 to 7, E to F, I to J. There's only two places where they're different, 5 to 8 and 8 to 4. In fact, emails number 7 and 10 are about 84% identical. We've seen other duplications. For example, emails numbers 3, 5, and 13. 3 and 5 were 52% identical. 3 and 13 were 55% identical. But 5 and 13 were only 35% identical. So if this were genealogy, we would say that 3 is the parent of 5 and 13. The other interesting thing, I mentioned that some emails contain one message and some emails contain two messages repeated. If there's only one hidden sequence, one message, then it may or may not be a duplicate. But if there are two hidden messages, then the first one is almost always a duplicate, and the second one appears to always be unique. Now, regular spammers will not change their code until their code becomes ineffective. But covert channels frequently change their code rapidly. For example, about a month after this group started up, or at least a month after we first noticed them, they changed their message ID, or they changed their email header. They added a message ID, but it's not exactly random. It contains that B400A8C0. And if you get onto Google and you search for B400A8C0, you'll see lots of people that received email from this group. They also changed their abuse tracking header. It now says abuse 2 tracking and contains my Base64 single encoded email address. I guess they fixed their double encoding problem. And in fact, that's not the only time that they've changed the abuse tracking header. They've changed it lots of times, rapidly. This suggests someone with the actual source code or a system that's in development. And I mentioned that the content doesn't change. Well, they sort of got past that. Now the content does change occasionally. But consider this email. It's HTML text taken from some other spammer's email, but they added into it a text hash buster, two sentences taken from some girl's SAT vocabulary list that's available online. The SAT word is bridled. The sentence is, "I bridled Amber and made her obey me." And then they have the repeated hash buster. 5POP at the top is repeated again at the bottom, 5POP. Now, this group has been around for over a year, and they've been constantly updating their code and updating their methods, and they've pretty much perfected how to do their camouflage. Consider this email. It looks like a fish. It even has in the HTML code a link going off to some phishing server that would collect your information. If you take a look at the header, you can see that I received this email 2 weeks ago. The email header itself smells like a fish. It's what you would expect, except that there's a small problem. The problem is around that MIME header, generated by DAMS. You see, the content that I just showed you and this header come from a very well-known phishing group. We've been tracking them for months. But that phishing group doesn't use a generated by DAMS header. That's unique. In fact, the phishing group also doesn't fish from this particular type of server. You see, they are very careful about the servers that they pick. They choose systems that they know will be up for a long period of time. But this particular server was down the second we received the email. That's not like what we'd expect from this group. And this group doesn't use text-based hash busters. But we found some text-based hash busters in this particular phishing email. Do these look familiar to anyone? In fact, the pattern isn't just the abuse tracking pattern. It's not just in the plain text attachment. It's also in the content boundary. So we can start doing a little bit of analysis. And what we can see is that numbers appear more often than letters, although they've started including uppercase letters too, not just lowercase. And it has a delta IC value of 2.88. That is so far above random that it's really hard to say that this is random. The reason it's so high is because there's repeated pairs of numbers all throughout the sequence, like 71, 37, 99, 88. Those repeat throughout the sequence. Now, the abuse tracking group is known to reuse content. So we can take this particular string and compare it to all the other strings we've received from the abuse tracking group and see if any of them have anything in common. Well, unfortunately, there was only one match from almost a year ago to the day. In fact, of the original 128 characters, there are 12 characters in the same order with the same spacing between them found 1 year apart. And when you align those 12 characters, you get an additional 8 characters that are incrementals, 7 to 8, 4 to 5, 5 to 6. And in fact, those incrementals appear to be spaced apart at a 6-character interval. If you take a look on the bottom line, there's that on the first part of it, there's that 5 at the end with 6 characters over is a 6, 6 characters over is a 2, then 12 characters over is a 9. That's periodic. So what are the chances of having 12 out of 128 characters being identical, as well as an additional 8 characters being incremental with a period of 6 characters, you know, that kind of interval going on, a full year apart if this were random? Well, really tiny. So the big question is this steganography or is this spam? I mean, it could be a spam tool with a really bad random number generator That would explain things like the non-standard headers and the repeated sequences with some variation days or even years apart. On the other hand, it could be a covert message with some unknown encoding system. This would explain things like the content reuse, the non-standard headers in, and the non-random sequences in both the header and the content. That sequence duplication, it could be an ID, a reply, a resend, or maybe it's not even a message at all. Maybe it's a key exchange. The other thing is, we monitor multiple email addresses. And some email addresses receive email from this group, and then others, and then sometimes both, indicating multiple mailing lists. So there's probably multiple individuals involved. So to summarize the abuse tracking group, they're an interesting spam group. They're a potential covert channel because they reuse content, they include non-random repeated sequences, they appear to have multiple members, and they rotate their software rapidly. In other words, they stand out as being weird, but we don't know anything else about them. And unlike the Hangouters, this group is still active today. So to wrap up this talk, hopefully I've shown you that not all spam is what it appears to be. I've hopefully shown you how email and mail headers work, as well as techniques for tracking, identifying, and classifying spam. Are there any questions? Thank you all very much. Oh, wait, question over here, sorry. The question is, have I tried running the character frequencies through different languages to see if the delta IC value matches up to whatever the language distribution should be? Yeah. So far, we've run it through about 30 different languages. We have dictionaries of different languages, and no matches with any of them. It doesn't appear to be a substitution cipher. Okay? Thank you all very much.